From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journeys Fire. Welcome to the program. If you're listening to this program a few days earlier, we had quite a stir in Washington, D.C. at the United States State Capitol. A coup, I believe, was trying to take place. And that's not the topic of today's program, but it brought up the great division that we have in this country. And thinking about ways that we can get beyond that. And you know, one of the things I read in the hospice work that I also do, as many of you know, I've often talked about that in the programs that I've had on this show, that death can also be the great equalizer, because it reminds us that nobody gets out alive, that death is the most democratic thing on the face of the earth. It will take both Republicans and Democrats. And what I've learned is when you are serving someone who's dying and their family, you don't even ask what political party you're about, because you don't even care. And hearts and minds are soft and pliable. And when a person dies, for the most part, might be different in various cultures, but for the most part, people grieve the same way. They cry. They mourn because they've lost someone worth grieving. I had made a post earlier today on Facebook thinking about what had happened in this country, but also thinking about our topic today. And the quote from someone else said, "Anyone can slay a dragon," she told me, "but try waking up every morning and loving the world all over again. That's what takes a real hero." And then what I added was this: the world now is too dangerous and too beautiful for anything but love. So I thought about love, and I thought about the real heroes. And I got to tell you, for my money, it's people who work for hospice, often called midwives to the mysteries, from management to marketing to the RN case managers, social workers, chaplains, aides, day in and day out, serving those who are dying. Because most people I know personally can't believe I even do something like that, or why I don't find it morbid. Well, I wanted to have a conversation about this on today's program, and I thought about the various people that I know in hospice. And one of my all-time favorite nurses is Amy Montgomery. Amy grew up actually in Cincinnati, and she got a degree from IU. I won't hold that against her as a Boilermaker, but she got a degree from IU in Germanic Studies and Business, and actually worked in marketing and sales, and for a high school foreign exchange nonprofit before staying home to raise her kids. And then went back to school midlife for a nursing degree, her RN, registered nurse. And she says to this day it was the best decision she ever made. I have witnessed how Amy is with not only her patients, but the families that she serves. And she just raised the bar in terms of service and heart and knowledge. And so I wanted to have a conversation with her about death, about dying, about hospice, because to me, hospice is the best movement in the world. And even when I have stepped out of hospice and then come back later into it, I've been in it now 17 years total, I'm always sharing the good news about what hospice is all about. So it's a joy and an honor for me to welcome today's program Amy Montgomery, and she's joining us from Zionsville, Indiana. Amy Montgomery, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You know, when I thought about doing a show on hospice, which is certainly my favorite movement and a passion of mine, the 17 years that cumulative I've been involved with, I thought, well, who do I want to come on to talk about not only hospice, but perhaps even share some stories? And maybe we call this Confessions of a Hospice Nurse. But I knew it had to be you, because I've had the honor of serving with you, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. So as full disclosure, I want to share with my listeners that we work together for the same hospice company, a new hospice here in the Indianapolis area. I want to share that. But also I had a chance to see you, not only interact with the patients and families, but also facility staff if you're in a facility. And you're always the top of your game. You're very passionate about what you do. So thank you for sharing your time with us today, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
Well, me too. It's been an honor to work with you. I appreciate it.
Now, you didn't right out of high school go into college thinking you were going to be a nurse. I shared just a little bit about that in the bio, but let's talk about that. Where did that desire come from?
It wasn't on my radar in any way. it really came, to be honest with you, not even out of a passion for nursing, or I'll be honest, not even out of a passion for serving others at that time of my life. I needed and wanted a job, and it needed to be flexible, and I needed an income as a single mom. And so that's what I turned to. I talked to a lot of people, and it seemed like you could do an awful lot within that field.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I got into it, then the more my passions for serving others and for doing the actual work of nursing became just as much important as the other things.
Now, that's interesting, because oftentimes people have it the other way around, but that makes sense to me. You know, we start off in certain areas and we're doing it for a while, and either because our desires and joys change or our lifestyle changes, and we look at something practical. But what I've heard you just say is, once you started getting involved with it, you started to get that passion in it.
Yeah. I'm just being honest. That's where I was coming from at that time in my life, and it has definitely grown on me. It was the best decision I ever made to go back to school and into this field.
Now, when you became an RN, did you go right into hospice, or did you work at a hospital first?
Well, this is funny, because I was a student nurse extern at Community Hospital North, and believe it or not, it was in maternity for over a year, and I loved it. The babies and the mothers, I enjoyed it a lot. But at the time when I graduated from student to full-time nurse, they only had a nighttime opening, and I wasn't ready to work a night shift.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Still had the kids at home, and so I actually looked online, and I found this position. They were willing to take me as a newbie in the field, and it was in my area where I live, and I really just, it just came together, the timing of it.
I love that. I love that. I'm thinking about a line out of West Side Story, the great musical, from womb to the tomb. You've served the babies and now the elderly who are making their transition to the next life.
Yeah, a full circle.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah, because I know oftentimes people call hospice workers midwives to the mystery. So you know what that's like. I didn't realize that you served in maternity for a year or so. You know, it's funny. People ask me how I got in hospice. It wasn't on my life plan. I'd been in ministry, and my spirituality just started growing and growing, and basically I just stopped fitting into one particular church. So I started a coaching practice, got certified in that, and a nurse friend of mine called me out of the clear blue and said, "Do you miss being a pastor?" And I said, "Well, parts of it." And she said, "Well, we have an opening for a part-time chaplain at a hospice. Would you be interested?" And I said, "Hospice?" I said, "Isn't that for the dying?" And she said, "Yeah." And I said, "Okay." And so I did, and started off part-time, quickly went into full-time. And yeah, so sometimes our destiny finds us if we're just surrendered and open to the opportunities.
I was just going to say that. It found you. It found me too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, let's, for those who are still unfamiliar with hospice, because, and I know you can relate to this, when I have done a lot of public speaking, whether it be the professional speaking side or for hospice in the community, I'm still amazed of the people who don't understand what hospice is. So let's just start from the ground floor. What is hospice? What's it all about?
Well, for me, it's about quality of living.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like to quantify hospice as being solely about death, because for me, it's about living. I don't feel like I work so much in hospice to help others die. I work to help them enjoy the time that they have left and to make their last days comfortable. And then, of course, yes, to give them as most peaceful a passing as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that in society today, still, hospice is associated with the Grim Reaper and with death. And one of the reasons why I love the work and I've stayed in it is because I want to spread the idea that it's about the quality of living at end of life. It's not necessarily about end of life.
I find that's probably the most misunderstood thing about hospice. And I've even found that when I used to do some CEU classes, I would teach them in a lot of the hospitals in the Indy area. So it was with nurses and social workers. They still thought we're like the death angels coming in. They didn't get that it was about quality of life, because on occasion, because of that extra TLC, people can improve, and then we have to discharge them.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's how you know it's about the quality of living. We can improve that, and with that improvement in the quality of their life comes improvement in their health.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's even if it doesn't happen and their health doesn't improve with the quality of our care and time spent with them and our general hospice work, then they still can remain on hospice for quite a while. I mean, it's 6 months is the key term, the key timing. Mm-hmm. Hospice medical director and primary care physician both need to agree that this patient qualifies because they think that in 6 months' time, due to infections, wounds, decline in ability to take care of themselves, weight loss, that they might not last that 6 months.
Right.
But if nobody knows that, of course, so often they do go sometimes far past that.
Yeah, so that's important to know for those who are listening. If you have a loved one that's declining in maybe many different areas, it does take the primary physician, their doc, to be able to sign off and say there's decline in this area, maybe that area. And as best as I can tell, 6 months or less, which doesn't mean it's going to be 6 months or less.
That's right. And what I think is, it is starting to happen. I think we're turning corners in our society. For me and my age group, I'm almost 50. And so I have friends whose parents are starting to turn that corner, mm-hmm. starting to decline. And they actually, the more they hear me talk about it and see it out there, they'll come to me and say, when can I get my parents on hospice?
Yeah.
Please, you know, they're anxious to because they see the care and most of it being covered by Medicare when you're struggling at home or in a nursing home or, mm-hmm. you know, you're struggling to care for those loved ones that are aging and need extra care, not sure where to get it from, we're a good option.
Yeah. Yeah. And let's talk about the benefits of hospice because cumulatively, I've been in hospice 17 years, but a couple of times I would step away. I started a not-for-profit for 4 years and I came back and there's been things like that. But when even I was away from it, I was a proud and bold spokesperson for it because to me, the needs that it meets, it's an amazing opportunity and it provides a lot of different wonderful benefits for family. Can you just go through some of those? What they would get from a hospice company.
Oh, sure. We do an evaluation to decide what kind of care is needed. A typical patient would have extra one-on-one care from a nurse. So even if you're in a nursing home and there's nurses there, of course, or even in a hospital, that nurse comes and provides you with individual attention and time to review medications, to review vitals, to review how they're doing with the disease process that they even got on hospice for. On top of those nurse visits, you have an aide who visits and gives special personal care to the patient. It can be every day for someone living at home. Mm-hmm. It can be a couple of times a week for someone already receiving that care in a facility as well. In a typical environment, so not COVID world, you would also have pet therapy, music therapy. You have volunteers who can come and sit and spend time with you reading or even give family some time to get errands done if the patient is at home.
Yeah.
Of course, you have chaplains who provide very special care to the patient. And you have social workers who will come and spend time with the family and patient. So there's so many disciplines involved. There's an awful lot of extra attention, I believe, is the most special thing about hospice is that one-on-one care.
Yeah. Yeah, and the communication is crucial. I know with hospice companies, there's all, that what you described was the interdisciplinary team. And then either once a week or once every 2 weeks, the team gets together to talk about the care of the patient, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's a special time because that's really the main time that we can connect with each other. I mean, we're on the phone or we're in facilities together, but it's a time when we're all focused on one patient.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a team.
Yeah. Well, with the population, the boomers and others following, there's more and more people that are aging. And at some point, I mean, we all die. Death is the most democratic thing on the face of the earth. You're talking about some services that are, I think, pretty amazing, not only for the patient, but also for the family. So people are going to ask, wow, is this too good to be true? What's the cost? And what do you say to that?
Most of our patients receive our services through Medicare. So mm-hmm. if you're already giving money into that system most of your lifetime while working, this is a way to get some of that back.
Yeah.
Insurance, specialized insurance companies might allow hospice care within the insurance program as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
of course, you can pay for it out of pocket. We don't have as many as we do with Medicare and insurance, but it's a possibility.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, since I've known you, you've had other offers from other hospices. That's probably no secret. Maybe a lot of nurses have. But you've stayed at ANU. Why is that?
Oh, for me, it's 100% about the people that I work with.
Yeah.
The team, you know, you want supportive people around you. You want people that you respect and you can count on. People who have your back. That happened to me today. I have a family who's really struggling, and I ran into our chaplain at the facility I was at today. And I stopped her and told her a little bit about this family who's just struggling with a lot of guilt with their loved one in this facility recently placed. And I just told her that they'd been, I'd been doing a lot of education, and there were a lot of phone calls back and forth. And I just asked her if she could sort of step in, give some extra care and time to this family. And she understood and immediately was willing to step in.
That speaks of the advantage of, if a person can qualify, the sooner they get on service, the sooner they can take advantage of not only the services that most people think of, and that's services by people such as you, the nurse, and an aide that can come in, but also psychosocial, social workers and chaplains that can provide some of the spiritual and emotional healing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you only have one shot at your passing. I know that sounds maybe silly, but you don't get a do-over.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to make it as special and as comfortable and as understandable, as painless for the family as well as for the patient. And the more time we have to get there, the better it is for the patient and the family.
Yeah.
That's something important.
People might want to know what your typical day is like, but I think I know the answer to that. There is no typical day, is there?
No, I could easily spend half a day charting or on the phone with doctors and other nurses and family members and following up on orders. Or I could spend a whole day, most of the day in my car. Mm-hmm. Some days I drive, for example, to Bainbridge, and that's about an hour away for me.
Yeah.
Some days I spend the entire day in several different facilities, nursing facilities, or I might be in people's homes.
Yes.
Most of the day. It does change a lot, but that's what I like about it.
Well, and that's the advantage and disadvantage of working for a hospice company that's not at a hospital, that you are out in the field using your car. And I know, well, people like you and me, for example, I kind of like that. I like that freedom a little bit. But there also comes some stress with that, too, especially when there's bad weather, there's heavy traffic, what have you. But that's part of the job as well. What do you enjoy most about what you do, if you had to pick just one or two things?
For me, my favorite part of the job is education.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I believe that it's because of death that we have meaning to our life.
Yes.
And so rather than deny it, why not try and understand it? Mm-hmm. I also believe that the grief that comes with someone passing gives meaning to compassion and empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And I can play a hand in bringing those things together for a family or for a patient.
Yeah.
And that to me is an incredible honor. That's what I like the most. So for me to walk into a room that's filled with strangers to me, family members of the patient, I mean, at times they're strangers if I haven't had a lot of time with this dying person, if they've just come onto our service.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all in different places. Some are angry about what's happening. Some are in denial. Some have accepted it. Some have accepted it but have no idea what's really happening.
Yeah.
They don't know the signs of death, how to look for it, what to expect. So for me to be able to make that experience a little bit easier with the education I can provide about what passing is like, what things I'm looking for, how it's affecting the patient, what it's going to look like day to day, what's typical, I can relieve some of their suffering, both patient and family, and that to me is an incredible experience in my job.
Yeah, because not only are the days different each day, but each family, each patient is going to be different, and the needs of that patient could change from day to day. So you got to be quick on your feet. The other thing that what I admire about you so much, you have good people skills. And you know, people think, well, you got to have the expertise in this area, or as a chaplain, expertise in that area, social worker. But I tell you, there's something about having great interpersonal communication skills. And you're a people person. Have you always been that way? Can I talk to your kids? Put them on the phone.
No, thank you. But, well, I am, yes, I'm definitely a people person. Strangely enough, I really don't like a lot of attention on me, but I feel very comfortable, like I said, walking into a room where I don't know a lot of people, but they're needing something, and I can provide that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a comfort zone for me. And of course, it's not all about providing something for them. Of course I get something out of it, and I can give you some examples.
Mm-hmm. Please.
I've had a patient that stands out in my mind that I'll never forget her. She's probably the youngest patient I've ever had. She was in her early 30s, and she had throat cancer. She had a tracheotomy, and she was unresponsive and had been that way for many days, which is normal when you're heading down that road. But she was not taking her last breath, and this was going on, and the room was, this is, of course, pre-COVID, and the room was surrounded with loved ones, and, you know, there just was something unfinished that she was not able to let go for some reason, and the mom was in the room, and she had released the daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, I love you, it's okay to go, and that wasn't doing the trick. And so I thought about it, and I questioned the mother, what do you think it could be? And she finally came up with, well, I'm a diabetic, and it could be that my daughter's worried about me because I often don't take care of myself like I should.
Oh.
Take care of my disease. And she had landed. She had herself landed in the hospital several times for diabetic incidences. And I suggested she get that detailed with her daughter and tell her that she's going to take care of herself, specifically with her managing her diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And that daughter passed away took her last breath within 5 minutes. I was standing right there. It was one of my first experiences and my first understanding that even though you don't think they can be, that they're aware of their surroundings because of their coma-like state.
Yes.
They know what they need. The dying person does. And they will hold on for that if they can.
Do you find that most people know that, or is that one of the things that you try to educate the families on, that very thing that you just shared?
No, most families have no idea. And that's why you ask if I'm a people person. When I can provide something like that and change the way they see the situation and change what they say to the dying person so that that person can let go, it's an incredible feeling.
Yeah.
So I think somebody who's not a people person but can provide that education and that understanding,
mm-hmm.
and support and just, mm-hmm. being there, you can do it. It doesn't really, you know, as long as you've been able to yourself have that learning of what hospice is all about.
You know, a lot of people have a fear of death. I'd like to know, first of all, just in your life, even before you became a nurse, what was your first experience with death when you saw someone take their last breath? Or did you?
Oh, I was much older. I didn't lose a parent young. Mm-hmm. I lost my grandmother recently. Mm-hmm. I don't have a specific personal death story to tell.
Yeah.
What I do have is experiences. I've done some traveling, and I also have hosted foreign exchange students, and for me to know how their countries handle the process of dying,
mm-hmm.
And living has been has always pointed me towards this field, I believe.
Yeah.
I've always been interested in the differences in the cultures, because I think early on I saw that our culture does it. My perception was our culture doesn't do it very well.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with you. Could you share more, though, about what you learned in your travels regarding death and dying?
Well, sure. Most recently, I hosted a foreign exchange student from Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Putri. She's 17 years old, and she lived with us for almost a year. COVID cut that a little bit short. But she told me something that I found very fascinating, and that's when a family member passes on in their family in Indonesia, if it's a matriarch of the family, let's say, then the females of that family from 2 years old on up, they will gather around that body and they themselves provide postmortem care. And so they will clean the body together and they will wrap it. And then they have a funeral procession. So that's something very different from the way we do things here. I first discovered with traveling that there's so many different ways, you know, with cremation and burying the ashes underneath a tree. Some families are very open in talking about it. Mm-hmm. In Asia, specifically China, Japan, they believe that you're just going into another realm. It's not an end per se.
Yeah.
Everything doesn't just screech to a halt.
It seems in the Eastern, in the Asian countries, there's more of a organic knowing and integration early on about that, because when what you just shared, I would think, well, Christians say they know when they're going to die, they go to heaven. But I've seen a lot of Christians struggle, or families, almost as if they don't believe it, like help my belief, God, you know. And yet I've heard the same thing from some friends of mine, one in particular who goes to Bali twice a year. And over there, it's a natural thing. Babies are born, people die, and it's just as you described, your experience.
Yeah, I feel like in America we view death as a failure,
something yes.
that you didn't beat.
Yes.
And I also think a problem, whether you're a Christian or not, is communication. It's just not discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the families, when I get them, that's something else that I can offer. Let's talk about what it's going to look like, possibly, or have you gotten these things arranged so that your family can grieve and not have to deal with all of these details?
Yeah. Yeah, communication is key, and that is a passion of mine also, the cultural differences, and trying to bring death out of the closet. Now, I know there's things like death cafes and things like that that are cropping up everywhere, but still, it's still not mainstream for a lot of people. And it's funny, we'll talk about anything and everything under the sun, but the minute you want to talk about death, it's like silence, crickets. It's like, that's
exactly
morbid.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. I'm a buzzkill at a lot of places. I'll tell you, my kids now, I come home and I'll tell them about my day. And of course, it includes some death, and they'll roll their eyes. They get pretty tired of me. It's my death talk. But it's what I do. So
yeah.
It's what I talk about often, and I can't help it.
Yeah. No, I'm the same way. I remember talking to a high school friend of mine, Alan Wolfelt. We're always jealous of Alan because he had this most awesome lawn mowing business, since he was the one guy in high school making all this money. He could go out on more dates because he had like 30 or 40 lawn contracts. Well, one of them was with a cemetery in Lafayette. And his story is he would stop when there was a graveside funeral out of respect, and he would watch the people. And that intrigued him so much. He wasn't really sure where he wanted to go to college or what he wanted to do, but that's what prompted him on the path of eventually becoming PhD Dr. Alan Wolfelt, writing, I don't know, 40 or 50 books on grief, and he's known worldwide, lives in Fort Collins, Colorado now. But when he came back to Indianapolis one time, he's often come back, but I saw him once and we reconnected, and he shared with me about grief, the importance of grief, because he says people don't grieve in this country like they do in other countries. We like to bottle it up. We like to medicate it, or we like to put our loved ones service. We don't even have services half the time. We'll just put it on the plastic. That's what he said, the Visa card, whatever. And we go on with our lives thinking we're okay. But he says grief will eventually come out one way or another. And then he said at that time, in the state of Colorado, funerals, the amount of funerals had been cut in half. And he said to the audience, and that's not a healthy thing. So you're right, how we still are more sterile about how we handle death and dying.
Yes, I would agree with that. It's a hard thing to get through.
Yeah.
They're hard emotions.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like I said earlier, it's getting through those emotions that give you meaning to how to be compassionate and have empathy as you go on after that grief process.
And that can provide so much healing and help us let go of so much baggage that we're perhaps not even aware of. Maybe it's unconscious, so that we can eventually, I mean, my goal at least is to start walking lighter on the earth and not heavier with all those burdens. I want to ask you, you were in the maternity area for a while, then you got right into hospice. Do you remember the first death you attended as a hospice nurse? What was that like for you?
I remember that it was scary and shocking. I mean, it took me a good year in hospice to really feel comfortable myself with death and educating. And a big thing for a nurse in hospice is being able to sort of predict. That's what all the families ask you and want to know. Well, how long does my loved one have? And that's, you know, it's impossible. Not entirely impossible, but it's very hard for us to predict unless it's very near the end. And I remember that one of my first ones, she was sitting up eating dinner, and the next day I came, she was gone. And that happens. It even happens still today with my years of experience. But it's not norm. It's not the norm. And it can be very disconcerting because you feel like your job is maybe to give the family a heads up. You better come in and say your last words, you know, sit bedside if you can. And when you can't give the family the opportunity to do that, it's disturbing.
Yeah.
Because you feel like you haven't done your job as well as you could.
Right.
And so that, I remember that being, and I remember another experience where I thought the patient was going to be passing soon. I called the family together. I said, this is what I see and this is what I'm thinking. And some family members flew in from near and far, and they all gathered, and she probably lived another month or two. Mm-hmm. I was a real newbie nurse, and they were looking at me like, what's going on, when the next day she was sitting up in bed eating yogurt. So I learned a lesson then. I can certainly, tell them what I'm seeing, what I'm thinking, but I won't give making a decision about whether to come. That has to be up to them. It's not something that I would ever advise, just not really knowing what the next day is going to hold, because you really don't until you get to a certain point.
And one of the beliefs family seems to have, I know people say you shouldn't die alone, but some families will just wear themselves out taking that so literally that I have to be there, I have to be there. I haven't slept in 30 hours, but I have to be there. And sometimes I have found that perhaps that loved one is waiting for them to leave, for them to pass away.
Oh, absolutely. One of the patients I had early on also, he had a very large family, and he had a room, a single room, and it was a large room, so they could all fit in there, and they did. And I think it must have been nonstop, and I was trying to do educating about giving him some space. He said he possibly wouldn't pass until he had that, and there were just, they just didn't want to hear that.
Yeah.
So I came one time for one of my last visits. He was obviously in the last stages of his life, and a doctor walked in, and I saw the doctor go to the corner of the room to talk with family, and all the family turned and focused their attention on the doctor. And I was standing in the doorway, and I looked at the patient in the other corner of the room, and that patient took his last breath right then and there. And I felt like he was waiting for that moment when the tension was off of him. That was going to be the only time he had to do this his way, which must have been somewhat to be alone.
Yeah, yeah.
And I find patients, I think everyone's heard stories like this, or a lot of people have, where patients are bedside, their family bedside, and then the kids leave to go get a cup of coffee or to go to the bathroom, and that's when the patient passes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe in just coincidence. I think they know exactly what they're doing. I've seen a wife sitting bedside to her husband, and she doesn't want to let go. And there was one wife who just, I was counseling her, maybe you could tell your husband that you're going to be okay. Maybe he needs to hear that. And she looked at me and said, I'm not going to tell him that. I'm not going to be okay. And that's hard to hear. And it's hard, you know, my heart was aching for her because I knew, I felt like I could understand her pain. She didn't want to let go. She was in some denial, and I just looked at her and said, well, you are going to be okay, even if you don't feel like it now, and this is for him. He needs to hear that because of his love for you.
Yeah.
So let's do this for him right now. And she got to it eventually, and he did pass when he heard it.
Mm-hmm.
You see things like that There's so many stories like that over and over. They really can plan it. They know when they want to go.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, so much of this is a mystery, like in the unconscious, subconscious. I always believe, and there are research backing up some of this stuff, that when that person is active, meaning they are in the process of dying, and maybe they're not conscious, they can't speak, but they haven't passed yet. There's like this threshold, this room, whatever. And I think there's some beautiful things that are taking place in there. You know, in the Hebrews, in the Bible, it says, "And many clouds of witnesses look down upon us." I've always believed that's our loved ones who've gone on before. It's angels. And so people sometimes will ask me, well, are they saved? And I think, okay, here's the question. And can you get them saved? That happened even about a month ago. And, you know, my response is, well, I try to be respectful of everybody's faith, but I also do believe that those who come from a Judeo-Christian point of view believe in God, and that God is loving, God is amazing, and God's grace is amazing. There's even a song about that. And something does happen in our subconscious, and that's what the research is going on. Somehow they're finding that our consciousness goes on into eternity. Now, just saying that blows my mind. That's a whole nother program on a whole nother show. But right. Something takes place during that time. And when I've studied afterlife, people who've crossed over and have come back, Anita Morjani's been on the program. She's probably one of the most famous ones. Dr. Ibn Alexander, people like that. They'll often say the same thing. They'll say, it's beautiful. It was light. It was bliss. It was unconditional love. Ibn Alexander, who's an atheist, he saw dogs and pets up there. I believe pets will be up there. And so David Kessler, who's been a frequent guest on this show, he's a grief expert. His take on that was he felt like heaven, afterlife, nirvana, depending on what your beliefs are, that whatever you see is probably going to be based on your beliefs. If you're Buddhist, maybe you'll see Buddha. If you're Christian, you'll see Jesus. If you're this, but it's beautiful. And I have a real peace about that. Now, I want to go back. I asked you that question about your first death. I'll always remember mine. I was an associate pastor at a church in Brownsburg. We had several people at that time on the cancer ward on the fifth floor at Methodist Hospital. I'll always remember that. Fifth floor at Methodist Hospital was not a favorite thing to hear. When one of your, and they were all friends when you're a pastor. They're not only a someone that you're serving, but they're a friend. His wife of one of our elders, Joni. Joni was there, and I happened to be there when she took her last breath. That was my first experience with that. And I remember to this day leaning in and seeing that, and I didn't say anything, but inside I remember going, wow. It was like in a millisecond of time, she's gone. And I found it to be a rather beautiful experience, heartbreaking for family, absolutely. But beautiful also. And I remember a time, it's only happened once, and this was a patient at an assisted living close to St. Vincent Hospital, and the witnesses were not only myself, but a facility nurse and an aide. We were standing around him, he was looking up, and I know you've had experiences like this. People, they're seeing things, and you know they're seeing things, they're looking up. Well, when he passes and takes his last breath, now, this is going to sound insane, and I've only had this experience once. We all saw a vapor trace after he left his body. I know. It's like it still gives me chills thinking about it. But I'm wanting to know, Amy, because of all the patients that you've served, what was the hardest death for you, if you could choose one?
That's a good question. Two come to mind. One's very personal because that was my grandmother, because I was not her hospice nurse.
Uh-huh.
But she was up in Northern Ohio, and I went up to see her, and I knew when I walked in the door that she was close.
Yeah.
I'd been back and forth before, but I knew at this point that she was close, and it was pretty much my first time to see someone real close to me in that state. It's a very different And I was able to call her youngest daughter, my aunt, and get her up there to be bedside for her passing.
Mm-hmm.
And then another experience that was hard but gives me chills when I think about it, because it was also incredible at the same time, was the passing of a patient in the facility. He had two daughters, and one of them was estranged from him. And he had been days of not being responsive, and the wife was visiting and the other daughter was visiting, and he was not taking that last breath. And the wife was sitting in the room, and she had the estranged daughter from him was on the phone with the mother, with the wife. And I asked her to put it on speakerphone, because for my passing, which I think about, of course, as a hospice nurse, when my time comes, I believe I will just need to know that my kids are safe, that they'll watch out for each other.
Yeah.
You know, that they're going to be okay. That would be what I'd need to know. And I couldn't imagine passing on not with no communication with one.
Mm.
No last minute with one.
Yeah.
So I asked her, I said, put your phone on speaker. And she did that, and you could hear the other daughter's voice coming through, and that's all he needed. He died right there, and that to me was more meaningful and more chilling than mm-hmm. other passings I've been at. Even when someone, mm-hmm. I mean, I've had plenty where someone's calling out for their mother or their sister, family members who have been long gone. That happens often. But with this, he didn't say a word. He didn't open his eyes, nothing. He just took his last breath the minute that girl's voice filled the room.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I think all we people in hospice have, we could go on and on with stories like that, but it's why we do what we do, because you are in a very special, almost holy place when you are able to witness the passing of a person. It's the passing of their life, not just that person.
Yeah.
And then the ability to provide support and comfort and care to the family.
And what you shared about that specific experience, tragically, is taking place a lot now that we're in this pandemic of COVID, where especially early on, family couldn't be there with the loved ones. And I would even see some of the news stories across the country in hospitals, especially. People are intubated. You got a mask on, family isn't allowed in. I mean, just thinking about it now, it brings tears to my eyes. And they're dying alone, and no one can touch them. It's almost like modern-day leprosy back then. And so, yes, you're right. People like you, our other nurses, aides, social workers, you know, chaplains, we can use our iPads. We can use all the technology now. I had a patient who never talked to me, and one of our nurses said, well, get his son to talk to him. I said, oh yeah. So I called the son, actually nephew. I put the nephew next to his ear. All of a sudden he starts talking. And so when I hang up, he continues to talk to me, but he needed to hear the nephew's voice first. And so, yeah, it's all different like that. People oftentimes talk about a good death. How would you describe a good death?
Oh, I've been to so many, and they're you know them when you see them. And it would be, first of all, where my job would come in for that would be able to get the family surrounding the patient. This is, of course, non-COVID times.
Yeah, yeah.
The important people to that person in their life.
Mm.
I have had families who want to bring in the patient's music and it's playing softly in the background. This is part of the education that I do that I think is so important, and that's to tell families, why not have a life celebration with that patient prior to the patient passing? And what that means is simple. It's just sitting around with their loved ones, with your sisters, your brothers, friends even, and just share stories. You can laugh, you can cry together at the bedside, hold their hand while you're telling the story. But that's kind of what you're doing when you have a life celebration or a funeral. That's what you're doing. You're looking at pictures and you're sharing stories and love. And doing that for a patient prior to passing, I think, is an incredible gift to give them before they go.
Yeah, yeah.
And we know that hearing is the last to go. You know that they're, you know, from the stories I've shared, they're aware, even if they don't look like that physically. Some families have provided candle, you know, some candlelight, especially if it's in a home. You have a little bit more flexibility with what you bring in and what you have there if you're in a home.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be more personal if it's in a home.
Yes, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to negate the use of some medications. We have what we call comfort medications at end of life. And if they're experiencing high temperatures, if they're experiencing increased respirations, things that are typical to see in someone who's physically letting go from this world, some medications, just as in childbirth, can provide a lot of peace and comfort. And sometimes it's even just as much for the family as it is for the patient, whose families can struggle to see their loved one who's going through this process. It would be like seeing a birthing mother, be in a lot of pain, breathing changes. That can be sometimes monitored and helped with medications. And it's not really different with the dying.
Well, and the whole area of pain management brings up education, which is something you're passionate about, because people do need to be gently and lovingly educated about that. Because I know some families balk at medications, thinking they don't want their loved one drugged out, but their loved one is in pain. And we don't want them to have to experience the pain. And as we've already talked about, the last thing to go is our hearing. People can still hear us.
Yes. And for me, with education, if you can relate it back to the process of birth, which I actually do often, because I find that symmetry between life, giving life, and life leaving to be beautiful. Of course, one has joy at the end, one has grief at the end, but there can be joy at the end.
Yeah.
That's our goal, is to have that be a part of the process of even of grieving. But I use the example that when you have a child is born, as they grow, they have increased eating and decreased sleeping. And you find exactly the opposite process at the end of life. You have decreased eating and increased sleeping. And when you can put it in that perspective, it's very palatable. It's understandable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because a lot of it can, to use my teenager's term, it can freak people out when their loved one stops eating and stops drinking and becomes extremely thin. But for us in the hospice world, in the medical world, that's natural. That is what happens to many.
Yeah. Yeah. Early on in this conversation, you brought up about what death and also what the dying can teach us. So I'm curious, with the experience that you've had from your patients, from the dying, what have you been learning about life or love?
Well, I'm learning this about life from the dying, but also just from myself growing older. As I grow older, what becomes more important is time with my family. And it becomes more important to slow down. And it becomes more important to live in the present. You know, all of those things are out there and around there, but they're true for me. I've read about it, and I've learned about it from my patients, but I'm actually living it now as I get older myself. Those things become more important to me without having to, without it being a lesson that I read about in some magazine. This is how you should be living. You know what I mean?
I do. And so I'm always on the quest on how we can better prepare ourselves to live as if we don't have forever. I mean, certainly Tuesdays with Morrie, there's so many books, so many songs that have been cranked out about it. But I found that when I started maybe meditating on that a little bit, or reading a book or two here and there, or going or hearing the songs. I think Tim McGraw had a song, Live Like You're Dying. And truly let it drop from your head, which is knowledge, into your heart, which is illumination. It makes all the difference in the world in my life. And your priorities change, just as you shared.
Absolutely. And, you know, I hope I'm not dying anytime soon, but I've made a lot of the arrangements for when I do. That's something that's become important to me. I experience right now when I have a patient who's passed, I'm also still working and in touch with the family at times, and they struggle. What do we do now with the belongings of my loved one who's not here anymore?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a real challenge. And so I go home and I see all the stuff I've got at home and I think, what are my kids going to do with all this stuff? Even though, you know, I might not be going tomorrow, but I think about that. So I'm starting, the biggest change for me has been just starting to live my life with a lot of simplicity.
Yeah.
The stuff has become a lot, stuff in general has become a lot less meaningful to me. Mm-hmm. And maybe being a little bit more organized with my finances and how I want, how I have things arranged for when I'm gone. So there, you see an awful lot of, I just had a family who had a loved one pass and they made the power of attorney all three children.
Mm.
Or sorry, two children. There were two children in the family. And one wants to sell the parental home and one doesn't.
Uh-huh.
You know, and what do you do with that? It has to be worked out and hopefully they'll be able to do that. But it's just an added stress at a time when they're also grieving.
Well, and all too often, I know our social workers have to deal with that, that they'll find families that never gave any of that any thought. And all of a sudden they're in a panic trying to make these big decisions. But how cool would it be and how beautiful would it be, like what you're doing, if we could start earlier, have those conversations, so when the day comes at some point, and we never know when that's going to be, that's something we don't have to stress about.
Exactly.
You know, I'm slowly working on this book. And I collect a lot of quotes, and I wanted to share one with you. Actually, it's more of a description, but it concerns Abraham Maslow, great psychiatrist. And it goes like this. Shortly after the famous psychologist Abraham Maslow suffered a near-fatal heart attack, he wrote in a letter, "The confrontation with death and the reprieve from it makes everything look so precious, so sacred, so beautiful that I feel more strongly than ever the impulse to love it, to embrace it, and to let myself be overwhelmed by it. My river has never looked so beautiful. Death and its ever-present possibility makes love, passionate love, more possible." And I've seen that take place in with hospice patients and their families, that when they finally have worked through the perhaps anger, perhaps sadness and grief, and come out on the other side, it's like it gave them permission to finally say the things they've always wanted to say, or perhaps even do the things they've always wanted to do. But wouldn't it be cool if we could start doing that now and not have any regrets? People have often said, try to live life as if you have no regrets. I mean, that's so true. And letting go of the things that we've been holding on to for so many years. I think when a person is pronounced terminal, and I've not had that experience, I'm glad I haven't, but a friend of mine, Adam Hayden, has. He's been on this program before. He's got a grade 4 brain cancer, diagnosed 3 years ago. He's still alive. And although he's going through a lot of seizures, and he's public about this, when he's feeling up to it, he'll travel across the country and talk to doctors and nurses. And his message to them is to bring more humanity into healthcare, because this is what it's like to me being a patient with all of this. And he's also trying to educate the masses about not being afraid of death, because like the Buddhists teach, impermanence. I mean, everything breaks. Nothing lasts forever. And when we embrace that, it helps us stay more present in the moment. And so he's been kind of a hero of mine, just watching him personally go through that and embrace his mortality. Sometimes it's harder than others, but he has been doing that. And so I find that while I'm still very healthy, I'm trying to do that myself. And it does help me show up bigger and to love more fully and to love well. And to say I love you to family when I'm talking to them, because there's been times in the past I probably just forgot.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you brought up the medical staff in the hospitals, people dying in the hospitals with just the medical people around them during this COVID period. And I guess trying to find some of the positive things around this strange year and, you know, the epidemic, a lot of medical staff, they haven't been around death as much. I mean, they're in hospitals to heal people, right?
Yes.
That's where they're working, and that's what they hope to do. And then, of course, there's all kinds of things around about the education in medical schools, nursing schools, about classes on death and dying. There needs to be more education happening on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And unfortunately, they're getting a crash course in it right now. And if that does serve then to make some medical professionals view medicine in a different way and maybe have increased empathy and understanding of end of life, well, that's not a bad thing.
Yeah. No, it's not. It's not. And it's not over yet. But hopefully there's light at the end of the tunnel down the road. By the way, we mentioned Anu Hospice. You're one of the many great nurses that Anu has. Anu is spelled A-N-E-W, Hospice. The website is anucare.com, and the phone number is 317-300-2292. And Amy Montgomery, thank you, first of all, so much to have the courage to come on this program. And but thank you so much for the light that you shine in our community and the love that you share with our patients and their families. It's been beautiful, and I'm so glad you do what you do. In closing, I'd like to share a piece written by one of my favorite writers, John Pavlovitz. And the article he wrote that day was called On the Day I Die, and it goes like this. On the day I die, a lot will happen. A lot will change. The world will be busy. On the day I die, all the important appointments I made will be left unattended. The many plans I had yet to complete will remain forever undone. The calendar that ruled so many of my days will now be irrelevant to me. All the material things I so chased and guarded and treasured will be left in the hands of others to care for or to discard. The words of my critics, which so burdened me, will cease to sting or capture any more. They will be unable to touch me. The arguments I believed I'd won here will not serve me or bring me any satisfaction or solace. All my noisy incoming notifications and texts and calls will go unanswered. Their great urgency will be quieted. My many nagging regrets will all be resigned to the past, where they should have been anyway. Every superficial worry about my body that I ever labored over, about my waistline or hairline or frown lines, will simply fade away. Thank you for joining me. I so want to thank my friend and coworker Amy Montgomery for joining me. And for more information about Anu Hospice, you can go to anucare.com or give them a call at 317-300-2292. And that is today's podcast. I want to thank my engineer, Genesis Brown, and my production coordinator, Angel Richardson, for helping to make this possible. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.